Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. This week's guest is one of the nation's most recognisable and charismatic actors. Neil Stook has been in everything from BBC One dramas Silk and Dr. Foster to Silent Witness, Doctor Who, Jack Ryan, to name but a few, as well as films and theatre productions. Away from the screen, he's passionate about community and keeping local and independent businesses thriving, as well as saving Britain's pubs from closure. In fact, our paths first crossed when Neil asked if I'd join him in his mission to save pubs under threat from property developers. Well, more on that campaign to come, but Neil is on the beautiful Kent coast in Deal, where he's originally from. Good morning, Mr. Stook.
Morning.
I spotted you on the beach first thing in your bathing suit. Have you been for a dip today?
I do, yeah. I go at 7 in the morning, if I can. So it's a sort of ritual now. There's a gang of us, and we're hoping to go right through, so we'll see.
Wow, it must be good for the soul, is it, an early morning dip in the sea?
It's good for, I think, every single part of you, according to all the sort of people that are now experts on cold water swimming. Very good for the head, I think.
Yeah, and Deal's quite a special place, isn't it?
It's a beautiful place, yeah. It's becoming very, very popular, which is great.
You posted your so-called rush hour this week. I mean, gosh, it was absolutely stunning scenery. It's not the sort of rush hour I experience here in Shepherd's Bush, that's for sure.
It's a bit naughty. I think you've got to be quite careful how many posts one does of a beautiful sunrise. It can get quite boring, I think, for people that are stuck in lockdown.
No, it's a great place to indulge in cooking, I know, which I know you love. Lots of fresh ingredients. Is that something you do a lot of in Deal?
Yeah, I have this slightly romantic view of being able to go to a high street and shop in small shops. It's a view that's shared by a growing number of people. We're blessed here in Deal with so many fantastic local shops. You just go to the butchers, the fishmongers, the greengrocers, and you just get all your produce, just how it used to be. Just like a few pockets of London, like Muswell Hill and East Dulwich, etc. You know, those kind of places still have that. The further you get out of London and sort of go around England, there seems to be less and less of that. And supermarkets have come in and kind of wiped out these small businesses. And I've always been a big believer in community. And I think, you know, shopping, you meet people, you chat to people. It's a much nicer environment to do things in. That, for me, is my kind of huge bugbear, really. I kind of see where the planet has gone completely mad in supermarkets. And I get that people have to shop in supermarkets because all the small shops have been wiped out by them. And we're now realising, of course, that actually people knew how to save the planet in the old days because they didn't know any other way. So a milkman would come and deliver milk in a glass bottle that was then collected again. And butchers would just put things in a piece of paper. They'd never wrap anything in plastic because there was no plastic. And, you know, small little bakers making baking, you know, it was a better way.
And of course, in my grandparents' day, we'd all grow our own veg as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I don't know. I'd love to feel that people are kind of getting back to these ideals, but I feel it's still a small minority of people. So I feel a bit lost with the whole thing, but very blessed down here because this makes me really happy, you know, just getting a little shopping bag and going down the road and getting everything. I never have to go to a supermarket anymore.
And of course, you know, talking about your love of cooking, you got to the final stages of Celebrity MasterChef. I can't imagine the pressure of a show like that. Was that good fun to make?
When are you going on it?
Well, my friend Amma, who we were talking about earlier, my blind friend Amma, who's just been MasterChef's first blind contestant, has put me forward, but I don't think it'll happen. I can't cook. You know I can't cook.
He was extraordinary. He was extraordinary. Yeah, I picked a bad year, I think, because I was the bookie's favourite and I was doing really, really well. And yeah, let's just say I think John Turode preferred Lisa's buns to my sausage.
Of course, they're now married, so we'll leave it at that. So what was it like growing up in Deal? I mean, was it an idyllic childhood for you, Neil?
Really interesting. You know, my parents had a restaurant on the high street, so we were right in the thick of it. I think Deal's great if you're in the thick of it, if you're right sort of down there in the high street. We had a sort of magical time, especially in the summers, because you just sit on the beach all day long. And you know, it was a thriving high street. I can just, you know, it's almost magical now when you think of toy shops and things like that, things that kids don't have anymore. It's kind of wonderment of these shops, actually. And now it's not a bad high street, but it's kind of dying, like all those sort of Kent seaside high streets. But for us, being on the high street, living above the restaurant, a really sort of busy restaurant, that's great fun. It was fantastic. Having said that, I left when I was 16. But it was, yeah, just fantastic. What's happening to Deal now is sort of wonderful, really, because you've got all these amazing kind of artists and kind of creative people coming down here. So it's great.
I miss all that. And I think community is so important. And those conversations that, you know, the kids walking to school will have on their way to school with, you know, the postman, the butcher, the whatever, it all needs to be encouraged. I hope it's coming back, but I fear a bit like you that it isn't coming back as much as it needs to. I think the little businesses are still struggling very much. So as a teenager, did you have any idea that you'd get into acting?
No. Not at all. I was very lucky. We had a bunch of us who were fascinated with film and great cinema. And I took a very early fascination of acting and actors. And I suppose it all went in by osmosis and sort of subliminally, but it wasn't something that I then wanted to become. So I kind of drifted around London for quite a while. I was a drummer actually in a band down here, and I thought I was going to be a rock star. And then I kind of drifted around in London, which I'm quite good at. I'm quite sort of good at aimlessly drifting through life. And it wasn't till about 4.5, 5 years later, around about 19, 20, that people suggested I should probably get into acting. I was quite wild and I was having a good time. And then, I went to some workshops with the wonderful woman called June Abbott at the, I think it's called the Court. Well, yeah, she got me into drama school. So I got into a few drama schools and I chose Central because I'd never been on a stage before. And they had a proscenium arch theatre. And I thought, well, I've got to go there because you get what it's like, get the actual feeling of being on a proper stage. It was an amazing time, really. 30 years ago now.
30 years ago, but you're only 37, aren't you?
Just, yeah, 38 next year.
Same as me, funnily enough.
Well, so, we are the same.
We are the same age. We had the same big birthday the same year, so we won't go into any further detail. I think it was 40, wasn't it? That's fine. So stepping onto that stage for the first time, do you remember what it felt like?
I just remember everything felt so exciting, so sort of dangerous and new, just the right thing to do. I mean, it was absolutely the right thing to do, you know, full of energy and full of adventure. And I would say that education before then had not really been part of my life. And so I sort of felt at drama school like I was getting a sort of much better education. I started reading a lot more and I started learning a lot more about plays and writers, and I would go to the theatre all the time. And yeah, I suddenly became a very sort of strict disciplinarian as well about theatre and acting, whereas some of my fellow drama students weren't quite as disciplined as I was. And I think that's because I had no previous education and they'd come out of university and stuff like that. You know, I kind of felt like I'd left home when I was 16. I had no financial help from anybody. So I was, by the time I turned up at drama school, I was quite a kind of tough, almost like a sort of street kid, really. So I didn't really understand why there was lots of these quite privileged kids, you know, not turning up for classes and stuff like that. So there was a little bit of, you know, I needed a bit of time to calm down a bit, stop having a go at people for not turning up for classes.
And what was your first big break then?
I left drama school and I got 4 jobs straight away, which I just thought, oh, well, that's what happened.
You wish that would happen now, yeah. Hey? 4 big jobs on the same day.
Yeah. That was it, really. Theatre was my biggest break. There's no question about it. I came out at a time when all the pub theatres, the Royal Court, the Hampstead, all those kind of places, I did them all, the Bush. And we did, you know, quite sort of young. It was the time when, you know, all those kind of great playwrights like Joe Pennell and Nick Grosso and all these kind of people were writing all these quite sort of laddie plays and stuff. And I think that's what happened. I think people went, okay, so this guy's quite interesting. And then I suppose the biggest break on TV would have been Game On, which was, you know, big, very big.
It was big because, I mean, the show really was built around your character, Matthew, wasn't it? So it was massive.
It was, you know, same time as Men Behaving Badly and Fast Show and all that. It's when those Friday night comedies were watched by millions and millions of people. That's really popular. I mean, people talk about it daily on Twitter.
I know that people still ask you about it now. I mean, it was absolutely hysterical to watch. But what was it like to make? Was it a lot of fun?
It was ridiculous amount of fun. Poor old John Stroud, he's not with us anymore. Bless him, he walked out one day because we were behaving so badly. Yeah, so we got a good telling off for that day, but we felt awful because he's such a sweet man. Well, we were like three very unruly children, which I think a lot of people were trying to sort of corral.
So it was you, Samantha.
The wonderful Matthew Cottle. He's a lovely, lovely man. And, you know, we've all gone off and done our own little things. You know, I do mostly very serious work now, you know.
You haven't gone off and done little things. Your resume is extensive and impressive.
Let's have
a little trot through a bit of it. Let's start with the legal drama Silk, which was about life at the bar. And you starred as the clerk, Billy Lamb.
Heads or tails?
What?
Heads or tails?
Heads.
Heads it is. You're first. Let's go. My dad was a clerk. He got me in a clerking when I left school. I knew that this is my family. If you get Silk, they cannot touch you. Do only the work you want to do, but you have to get it first.
Spiffing, let's cram another one in, shall we?
Beautiful, this land of ours. This is England.
What appealed when you first read that? Because, I mean, he really was a central character in Silk, wasn't he?
Well, I think the obvious appeal for Billy was that wonderful sort of knife edge between good and bad, which I think is always very interesting with a character, slightly Machiavellian. He has a good heart because he wants to do everything for his lawyers and his chambers. But the way in which he did some of it was possibly questionable. Obviously, a character like that is going to appeal to anybody. There's a certain amount of menace, but there's a certain amount of good-hearted sort of East End boy. It was a wonderful mix. I mean, it's sort of tragedy that it didn't go further than three series, really, because we all felt that we were just starting to get to grips with our characters. And Billy was definitely a popular character. I mean, I feel really sorry for Rupert and Maxine, especially Maxine, because they really had to do so much of that sort of courtroom drama stuff. And
did you base him a bit on...
Yeah, I met quite a few clerks, actually. I know who Billy was based on, but I never met him. But I heard legendary stories about him. And I've now become very good friends with quite a few clerks. And they're fascinating characters. One clerk came up to me in the street and said, "Thank you so much for finally telling my wife what I do as a job." So it's an interesting, very sort of old traditional way of still running those chambers. But people didn't really realise that there was this sort of conduit between the client and the lawyer, a bit like an actor's agent in that sense. I didn't know. We didn't know when we first started it. And we went to Furnival Chambers and sort of hung out for a while.
And of course, Billy's storyline got very emotional with the cancer. What sort of reaction did you get from the public to that?
Well, again, the sort of prostate cancer, I then went on to become an ambassador for prostate cancer, which unfortunately I'm not anymore. For a while there, you know, we had this kind of incredible thing where I ended up producing a film for them as well with Ray Winstone and, you know, people like that, John Sim. It was really interesting because then, you know, you've suddenly got all these men suffering from prostate cancer again saying, you know, my God, this is fantastic. You are putting on mainstream television, the BBC, peak time. You know, you are talking about men's issues and men's problems. And I think it could have gone a lot further. Obviously, his treatment could have got more and more interesting as we went on. And I think, you know, it came to an end, unfortunately, as the BBC will do those types of things. They just end something that's very successful. I have no idea why. But yeah, so for a while there, I was very heavily involved with the prostate cancer lot.
I loved your Ray Winstone film. That was really moving, wasn't
it? Yeah. Charles Dance as well. Where we've got a fabulous cast. I think the prostate cancer people decided they were going to go more towards sort of sports people and stuff. So anyway.
Was it emotional to play, Neil? I mean, do you remember feeling quite choked up when you were, or perhaps a bit wrung out when you went home at the end of a day's filming?
Yeah, there were some really emotional scenes in it, which I must say I relished. But I mean, I didn't realise the profound effect that it was going to have. Men are useless at all these things, talking about health and stuff like that and illness and stuff. So it made a lot of men, grown men, quite emotional and want to talk about things, which I think is great. I always think that if, you know, people in a position that we're in, if we can help in some way, then it's great.
Dr. Foster, of course, was a real runaway success. I think it attracted, well, it was definitely more than 10 million, probably more than that in terms of viewers. Did the extraordinary viewing figures come as a surprise to the producers and writers? Because suddenly there seemed to be a rush for a second series.
It got more viewers than Downton Abbey's Christmas special. So I think 14 million or something.
Gosh.
Which is unheard of within those five episodes. I think it was five episodes of the first series, yeah. It broke all records and won all awards, every single award going, I think.
I know, you're at all sorts of award ceremonies with that. Did you expect it to be as successful as that?
Nobody expected that at all. I mean, you could tell something was going on, the chemistry. Mike's writing, who I also did a play, I did The Bull with him in New York. I mean, his writing is exceptional. But with the mix of Saran and Jodie, there was this sort of chemistry, this really exciting chemistry going on set. You could see that and you could feel that. And you could feel that Jodie was going to be a huge star. But that was about it. We just thought it was very, very good. The famous dinner scene took almost a week to film. Yeah, and we just, you know, you just thought this is really interesting, really exciting stuff. I'm very lucky to have been involved in so many good things. But, I mean, I spoke to Mike about it, the writer, and he was absolutely blown away by it.
You mentioned Jodie Comer there, who played your teenage daughter. I mean, gosh, she gone on to great things. I mean, starring as Villanelle in Killing Eve, what an amazing break for her. And she really is a superb young actress, isn't she?
Yeah, well, you know, what can I say? She's my daughter.
She is your daughter, yes. Did you teach her everything she knows?
Oh, honestly, you know what, that girl, I think, you know, we were all kind of blown away by her on set, really. It was one of her first jobs, I think. And yeah, you could just tell greatness was there.
You also guest starred in Doctor Who recently, which was very exciting to me because as a kid, I was the one hiding behind the sofa when the Daleks came on. Was that great fun to be part of?
Well, it's a national institution, isn't it? And the reaction that I've got from Doctor Who is just huge.
You were acting alongside a big rubber space rhino.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed working with those guys. They're very professional. Very bad breath and terrible toilet habits. But what do you expect if you're half rhino?
When you got the call, because, you know, we've said we're the same age. I mean, it is such an iconic show, isn't it? It must be quite exciting to add that to your list of fabulous things you've done.
There's a huge kind of thing going on Twitter at the moment where they're sort of slightly convinced that I might be coming back because now my wife is going to be the new Doctor Who, you know, that somehow I'm going to be appearing back, or I'm going to be a regular in Doctor Who and stuff like that. So that is the Whovians. The Whovians are, you know, working the whole thing out.
Oh, I hope the Whovians are right. And you've carved a niche as well, playing conscientious yet sceptical detectives. I'm thinking Chief Inspector Cook in Silent Witness. That's another of my favourites.
Yeah, I think I've been back, I can't remember how many times, I think I've been back three times as Cookie. And we were hoping that that was going to be a permanent fixture, that Cookie was going to be the regular detective on it. It's really sad that that he's not, but I get it. You know, it's not a detective show, it's a forensic show. So I absolutely love it. And Amelia is just incredible. All the gang down there are just brilliant. Yeah. Again, it's one of those things where you just feel, you turn up on set and you feel slightly blessed, really.
How do you cope with the unpredictability of acting, because, you know, sometimes it's all there and then sometimes there's quiet moments, and I know you've done a lot of stuff, but then there are times, aren't there, where the phone doesn't ring for a while. Are you good when there's a down period?
I'm getting better. You have to sort of almost go into some sort of meditation, really. I mean, I think I'm up for about six jobs at the moment. You don't get told if you don't get it. You only get told if you get it. So you sort of wander around doing shopping or whatever and go, oh, yeah, I'm up for that. I'm up for that. I'm up for this at the moment. And then it doesn't happen. You know, it's just, I'm very, very lucky. I made a lot of money in the 90s and I invested it very, very well. So financially, I don't have those worries, which, you know, thank God. And I know that a lot of actors, especially now during COVID, are having horrible kind of money worries and all those kind of things. So again, somewhat blessed not to have to sort of panic about money all the time, which I think is part of it, you know. And of course, it's so out of our control, unless you're directing it, writing it and producing it. So out of our control.
You do have to develop a thick skin as well, don't you? Because there are so many talented people up for these roles. So sometimes it isn't going to go in your favour. And I think that's something that me as a broadcaster as well, we've had to learn, haven't we?
I think that's right. I think learning to deal with disappointment. It used to crush me. It really did. And I would go into sort of, you know, black moods. But I've learned to deal with it a lot better now. But perhaps that comes with age. Perhaps it comes with not being so desperate for the money. You know what I mean? I don't know. I can't really speak for everyone on that one. I guess all actors, I mean, most actors are brilliant. You know, they're normally sort of fitness nuts and, you know, they're kind of gym bunnies and do loads of yoga and Pilates and all that sort of stuff. I go to the pub and have a Guinness.
I've watched you in theatre too. I mean, it's such a different discipline. How does theatre compare for you against film and TV work?
Well, it's bloody hard work for very little money. When I was younger, it seemed absolutely the right thing to do. Getting up late, going into work, going out afterwards and partying at Soho House, it just seemed like the right thing to do. It was quite rock and roll, really. I think as you go on and you have children and you know, you have young kids, and I'm in a slightly sort of zombie-like state the next day, it's less fun. Now my kids are getting older, I feel like I'm sort of ready to go back to the theatre. But the actual sort of going on stage is hugely exciting, and that sort of adrenaline buzz, which is obvious. And I didn't even used to think about any of that before. And so now that I'm even talking about theatre in those terms of feeling zombie-like, it being difficult with kids and stuff like that, I'd like to be in a position again where I do theatre where I can fully concentrate, not feel like a zombie in the morning and you know, really enjoy it for every moment. I think I'm going through what a lot of actors with children have gone through. It's harder to do theatre, I think.
You hear tales of actors being physically sick before performances. How do you cope with the nerves and also the pressure to remember the lines? Because the play I'm thinking of that I saw you in was a three-hander, so you were in it the whole time with a lot to say throughout.
Oh, honestly, the lines, God. I did a play for 6 months in the West End called Boeing Boeing. I took over from Mark Rylance. There is a really interesting part of the brain that I'm slightly fascinated by, where actually a week later, I couldn't remember any of the lines, but the lines that I'd been saying for 6 months. How extraordinary is that?
Gosh, that's amazing, isn't it?
I mean, obviously the brain is incredibly fascinating, isn't it? And people always say, how the hell do you remember your lines? And I suppose nobody really knows. It's a bit like when Richard Hammond woke up from his car accident, his terrifying car accident, and he spoke fluent French. He's never learned French before.
Do you get the nerves, though?
I don't get nerves. I get a rush of adrenaline that is intoxicating, and I cannot wait to get out there. I did a two-hander with Dervla Kerwin down at Chichester called Frankie and Johnny, which was a fantastic play. And I couldn't wait to get on stage, and Dervla was kind of in this terrible sort of panic. I almost had to sort of push her on every night. And she started getting so annoyed with how excited I was. I've never really had nerves. You do on press night, obviously. But mine is much more about excitement and fun, really. Let's go out and have some fun, you know.
Well, it was after a play I saw you in at the Old Vic. We had a quick drink afterwards that you told me about what was happening to pubs up and down the country. Therein started a rather big adventure for you and I, travelling all over Britain, really, finding out what was going on. Tell us a bit about why so many are closing, Neil. And I don't mean the ones that are closing that don't have any business anymore. I mean vibrant old pubs that are the lifeblood of a community.
It's all very depressing, this campaign to save pubs, because really you would have thought that the heart of the nation would be behind you and that everybody would be trying to save the Great British Pub. And over the years of campaigning to save pubs with these extraordinary campaigners who you and I both know, I really haven't seen a sea change or a change in people's mindsets at all. People in small towns and villages seem almost sort of ready for their local pub to close. They don't seem to put up any fight at all. Some do, of course. There's campaigns up and down the land, and you and I have been in these campaigns and we've actually saved pubs. There doesn't seem to be that kind of national pride in the Great British Boozer, which I hadn't really seen that coming. I couldn't quite believe that the rest of the country wouldn't join in with this, what I considered a really important campaign. It's much more than just talking about a pub, isn't it? We're talking about society. We're talking about socialising. We're talking about really important aspects of community life, where people go and meet and talk. And I never wanted Britain to become a sort of state of America where there's just these huge wastelands where you just get in a car, go to a supermarket, get out your car and go back to your house. That's kind of what's happening in Britain. And Mark Dodds, our friend and campaigner, is always so brilliant at describing why pubs are so fundamentally important to our communities. We obviously, you and I, realised that there was a sort of slightly more sinister aspect to all this, where people were able to get these buildings and redevelop them before people even knew what was happening. Some were knocked down, lots were knocked down, you know. How is this allowed to happen? Because, of course, there is the historical point as well, that they are part of our national history. So you were so brilliant when you got it on the One Show. But you and I have found it hard, haven't we, to try and get this out there.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I remember when we went to the village of Ash in Kent and got involved in trying to save a 15th century hostelry there, which was the only pub in the village and was down to be developed. I think the developers bought the pub before the community realised what was happening. And until we arrived on our white chargers to the church hall to tell them what was happening, they probably didn't realise that actually there was something they could do. And that's had a really great outcome, hasn't it?
Yeah, the Chequer, I think it got voted best new pub in Britain or something like that. It just shows you, really, the story about these developers. I think they bought three, so they got a really good price. They also bought the Red Line in Wingham, which sadly we couldn't save. And I think they get a much better price than the locals who want to try and save it. It's incredibly unfair.
after a very long and tiring battle, I mean, the Chequer is now actually owned by the community. Do you remember that evening in the church hall when we were trying to raise money to hire a barrister to help, you know, help with the fight? I mean, it was quite a special night, that, wasn't it?
It was a special night. And of course, it's really, really important for every community to get behind the saving of their pub. And it is down to the community. That was a very well organised campaign, and well done to the villagers of Ash for saving them. They also gave up many, many hours of their personal time to renovate it and restore it, you know, including roofers and builders and plumbers, etc. They all chipped in, and it's a wonderful, wonderful pub.
And then we had that lovely hour on the One Show where we did our pub special with Suggsy as our landlord. You were guesting, and I remember that 10-foot-high map in the studio showing just what a nationwide problem it is. And I thought it was really heartening to see how many communities contacted the One Show around that programme, saying, yes, we're in the same boat and we are fighting. So let's hope we did some good. It is a difficult campaign. It's a long campaign, but we met some great people along the way, I think.
Yeah.
We touched on your skills in the kitchen. You're also a bit of a dab hand at building and designing. And I've just been reading about your renovation of your Georgian property from where we're actually talking from today. You really like getting your hands dirty and stuck into a design project, don't you?
Not sure where it came from. When I first left school, I worked for a building firm down here, down in Kemp. So it's probably that. Most of my friends are builders, got great sort of chippy mates, and I'm absolutely fascinated by design. Design and architecture are probably my biggest passion, aesthetics. And so I very early on realised that I could, you know, buy a property and completely remodel it and redo it up. And I'm not very skilled, and I've certainly not been taught anything except the building skills that I learned when I worked for the firm. But I'm very good at sort of finishing and design and site managing and stuff like that. So, and also it's quite important, like a good director, I think, or a good landlord of a pub, to create quite a nice atmosphere on the site, because it can be quite unpleasant work and long hours, and especially down in Kent during the winter, very dark and wet and cold. So it's important to have a very good coffee machine, I believe.
Were there moments when you thought you might have bitten off more than you can chew? Because I remember you telling me in the early days that you lived in the property when it was a bit of a wreck. I think we're talking sleeping bag and a radio and perhaps a glass of wine, aren't we, really? Were there some tough days in the early days?
The builders called it the crack den. at least I had my copy of the Financial Times close to hand and Radio 4. Do you know what? It was tough work. And at times, I didn't think I was going to get through it. You know, it was hemorrhaging money, and we were discovering worse problems than we'd expected. And, you know, these things, you just have to kind of go on. You have to get a solution and you have to carry on. And I think actually towards the end, the builders who I were working with were so keen to kind of see this through, because it is a thing of beauty, this house. And it was more about putting the beauty back, really, than creating the beauty. It was more about what awful things had been done to it over the years. So it was with love and affection that we've sort of brought it back to its original state. And it's such a beautiful house.
Well, it's been brilliant to chat to you today, Neil, and also to find out a bit more about what goes on in your world. What should we look out for you in next?
I have no idea. I mean, I had a thing on called We Hunt Together. That was on Alibi this year. But obviously, filming has somewhat come to a halt for many people. And I can only say that if I get some of the jobs that I'm up for, then whoopee-doo, because they're fantastic jobs and quite exciting. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. And meanwhile, we'll keep an eye out for you on Deal Beach at the crack of dawn in your bathing suit.
Yeah.
Thanks ever so much, Neil. You've been a fantastic guest.
Take care.
You've been listening to actor and campaigner Neil Stook talking about his career and his passions from his beautiful hometown of Deal on the Kent coast. Next week, I'll bring you another fascinating guest. In the meantime, there are more than 20 Convex Conversation podcasts at convex.podbean.com to enjoy, featuring people like Countdown's Susie Dent, blind MasterChef star Amal Latif, Red One, the leader of the Red Arrows, Convex's CEO Stephen Catlin, and record-breaking round-the-world yachtswoman Dee Kafari. So do have a listen, and if you like them, share them with your friends and family. We're also on Spotify and Apple and Google podcasts, and actually Neil did confess at the beginning of this that he listened to me for 7 hours on his way home from France, so that's lovely to know. Have a lovely week. Bye for now.